Despite intense media scrutiny and public outcry, Democrat Anthony Clark will remain chairman of the Philadelphia City Commissioners. I'm Shai Ben-Yaakov, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. The three-member board that oversees elections again named Clark its leader during a brief meeting today. WHYY's Aaron Mozell has more.
Clark easily won a third term in November after running unopposed, but he's been under fire for months because of a spotty voting record and allegations that he routinely doesn't show up to work. Clark reportedly failed to vote in 2012 and 2013, as well as in the 2014 primary. He says his voting history has nothing to do with his ability to do his job, which centers on running elections and voter registration.
I'm an American, and I enjoy the rights under the Constitution that gives me the ability to exercise my rights like anyone else.
In October, weeks before city voters chose a new mayor, it took WHYY 5 visits to the city commissioner's office before we found Clark at work there. Here's what Clark had to say about his attendance.
Being an elected official, you get called to do different things. You're not just sitting at the desk. This is a world of technology. I'm always in communication.
That may not be true. Allison Perlman heads Philadelphia 3.0, a good government group. Her organization and others recently filed a right-to-know request with hopes of getting information about Clark's daily whereabouts. While they're still seeking that data, Perlman says she has learned that Clark does not have a city-issued cell phone or a city-issued computer.
It does raise a lot of questions about his ability to do sort of basic workplace functions in the absence of, I think, what we would all consider to be like the two most essential technologies required to work.
Clark will earn nearly $140,000 a year as commissioner's chairman. I'm Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
Five men who were convicted in 2008 of plotting an attack on Fort Dix are back in federal court in Camden. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, after years of national attention and controversy, the so-called Fort Dix Five have been given one last shot at fighting for a new trial.
The case started 9 years ago at a Circuit City in Cherry Hill. One of the men brought a videotape there to be made into DVDs. It had footage of the men skiing, riding horses, and shooting assault rifles in the Poconos. The Circuit City technician found it disturbing and called the FBI. The FBI hired informants, who investigators say discovered that the men had been plotting an attack at Fort Dix.
These homegrown terrorists can prove to be as dangerous as any known group, if not more so. They operate under the radar. Today we dodged a bullet.
That's FBI agent J.P. Weiss when the men were arrested in 2007. A federal jury convicted the five of conspiring to kill U.S. servicemen. They were sentenced to life in prison. At issue now, though, is why they didn't testify in their own defense during the trial. Now they say they wanted to, but were blocked by their attorney at the time. Lumi Kaija is a cousin of the three brothers and was among dozens of supporters in the federal courtroom.
If they testified and tell their side of the story, they would have had more innocence shed on their case. But they were misguided by the lawyers. They were misrepresented.
Other supporters, including Maha Halal of the National Coalition to Protect Civil Freedoms, say a new trial is needed because the men were entrapped by authorities.
The issue came about when FBI informants became involved and the fact that these individuals were Muslim, right? And the only reason they were criminalized is because they were Muslim.
On the witness stand, their former attorney said the five agreed not to testify after he advised against it. He said it would have been damaging because they held fanatical beliefs, like that 9/11 was an inside job. The new defense attorney for the men took pains to show that the former lawyer was disorganized, incompetent, and actively blocked them from testifying in their own trial. The hearings continue this week, and whether a new trial is called for will be up to the judge. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
It's no secret at this point that New Jersey Governor Chris Christie is pinning his presidential hopes on a win, or at least a good showing, in the New Hampshire GOP primary next month. It also probably comes as little surprise to Garden State residents that Governor Christie hasn't exactly been around all that much. According to his own records, Governor Christie was traveling outside New Jersey on 261 days last year, 56 in New Hampshire alone. Most of that time was spent campaigning. Joining me now to talk about Christie's absence and his reputation back home is Patrick Murray. He's director of Monmouth University Polling Institute. Patrick, nice to talk to you.
Same here.
This is certainly not the first time we've touched on Christie's time away from New Jersey on this show. Do New Jerseyans care how much time Christie actually spends in the state?
Yeah, that has been the major stumbling block for him in terms of his approval rating here in New Jersey. I mean, we had 76% of New Jerseyans say he was putting his own political future ahead of the good of the state. And so there was just a sense that he's turned his back on the state.
Now, Governor Christie has tried to defend his ability to govern while campaigning. And while it might sound a little empty for him to say, you know, his cell phone is always on, really, it is possible in this day and age to do most things remotely. Do you think being away has a real impact on his ability to govern?
I think it does. I think people have seen it that way. I think there's a tipping point. When he first started traveling, before he announced his run for president, when he was the RGA chair and he was doing a lot of support for other candidates, New Jerseyans were actually okay with that in the very beginning. In fact, they thought it was a good thing for New Jersey that he was out and about and that he could still do his job back home. What they're seeing here is that nothing's getting done in Trenton. They keep hearing that the pension fund is going bust, that the transportation trust fund is going bust, that all these things are happening, and Chris Christie isn't picking up his cell phone to govern. He might be reachable on his cell phone, but he just simply isn't even thinking about it. His mindset really is now on running for president to the detriment of everything else.
Well, you'd think that Democrats, who, of course, own a majority in the legislature, you'd think they'd kind of take this opportunity to get some of their priorities done or at least get something done. But like you said, there hasn't been a lot of legislative achievement in 2015. Who bears the blame for that?
Well, it's really down to both sides. I mean, there's no question that I understand why the Democrats in the legislature are frustrated because the governor just isn't there. And, you know, things get done when the governor and the legislative leaders sit down in the same room. And that's part of the problem here. He's not here to do that. But, you know, that wasn't happening even before he ran for president. And what's changed now, though, is that with him being out of state, the Democrats are trying to do all sorts of end runs around the governor. And it's simply no coincidence that they are now proposing a whole raft of constitutional amendments, which don't need the governor's signature in order to get on the ballot, trying to get the public to vote for things that the legislature and the governor should be doing. And in so doing, they're also squeezing in things that would benefit Democrats, such as a redistricting plan that would basically lock in a Democratic majority in the legislature.
Back in June, when Monmouth did its polling on this issue, Governor Christie didn't even win kind of a hypothetical GOP race in his own state. He trailed Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio. Since then, Donald Trump has obviously stormed onto the scene. Is there any sense of how Christie would do at this point among New Jersey Republicans?
It really is a big hypothetical because New Jersey is one of the very last states to hold its primary.
Right. This doesn't mean very much.
Right. So it's back in June. So if Chris Christie is still in the race by then, it means that the other candidates have kind of winnowed down and he probably would win. I'm not counting Chris Christie out yet because the dominoes have been falling in his direction. I mean, that's been the interesting thing is that there's a lot of things that have been out of his control that he needed to happen. And they've one by one, they have been happening. So it's possible that New Jersey residents and Republicans in particular might get their chance to decide whether Chris Christie gets the nomination if he's still in the hunt by June.
Just imagine a meaningful New Jersey primary.
Yeah.
Patrick Murray is director of Monmouth University Polling Institute. Patrick, thanks for speaking with me.
My pleasure, Shai.
Where have you gone? It's been so long.
After some questionable displays at this year's Mummers Parade, a move is afoot to have mummers go through sensitivity training before 2017. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports.
Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney says times have changed, and the mummers need to drop insensitive behavior disguised as humor or satire.
If you're a mummer group and you want to make fun of me, go right ahead. I'm a politician, I'm an elected official. You put a big mask on with my face on it and say anything you want about me. But you can't pick on trans people, you can't pick on gay people, you can't pick on immigrants. And it's not funny. It's not satire. Satire is something that is funny, not hurtful.
Rue Landau of the Philadelphia Human Relations Commission says she believes sensitivity training could be the way to go.
At the minimum, certainly different rules and policies, but sensitivity training and education is key. I think that We've got 12 months to do this. We can do this. We can make this happen.
Mayor Kenney says he believes face-to-face meetings could help.
Maybe some of our mummers sit down with some of our trans citizens and listen to them about how hard life is and how difficult life can be.
George Beatty is the attorney who's been representing the mummers for years. He says this could be a teachable moment.
I think that this situation that arose, we need to make lemonade out of lemons. This is going to be an opportunity to develop more dialogue, more understanding, and a deeper understanding of the circumstances.
There is no deal yet, but it seems very likely the Mummers Parade will look quite different next year. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
In today's headlines, special elections are now scheduled to fill four open seats in the Pennsylvania legislature. One will be held April 26th to replace Senator Dominic Pileggi in Delaware County. Also, the House of Representatives have set March 15th as the special election for three open seats, two in Philadelphia and one in Pittsburgh. Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane might be a no-show at the special hearing scheduled next week by the Senate committee considering her ouster. A spokesman for Kane says the embattled attorney general is still considering how she'll respond to the panel. Senators say a little-used provision of the state constitution gives them the power to request that the governor remove the elected attorney general. Governor Wolf has already called for her to step down following an indictment on perjury and other charges. Right now, 37 degrees in Philadelphia. Clear skies, not quite as cold as last night. We will have a low around 21 degrees. And tomorrow, fair skies, highs in the low 40s. Still ahead, in our country of immigrants, a young man retraces the route his grandfather took as a refugee from the Nazis.
I wanted to understand how far my family came, how much people sacrificed, what the journey entailed, just so that I could be alive today.
It's time for another Story Corner as NewsWorks Tonight continues.
Cabrini College is proud to support WHYY, now offering part-time doctoral degrees in organizational development and educational leadership. Cabrini can help you earn a PhD or EdD in 3 years without giving up your life. Their faculty and small classes help to expand your knowledge and professional network while giving you the tools to advance your career. More information on Cabrini's professional doctoral programs is available at cabrini.edu/doc.
A lot of old housing projects are coming down in favor of Section 8 vouchers. It's one thing to live where you're told, though.
It's another thing talking about having a quality resource for tenants to start their search and really get a leg up on getting their families into neighborhoods of opportunity.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. To get housing, you got to be able to find it. The story next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 on WHYY.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Shai Ben-Yaakov, in for Dave Heller. After people are released from jail, many can't go home again and find it nearly impossible to secure stable housing. Without that, they're potentially a cost and safety risk to the community. Keystone Crossroads' Emily Previty reports on how one Pennsylvania county cut recidivism rates and expenses, but not everyone's on board.
Zach Hassinger's apartment in downtown Lewisburg near Bucknell University is pretty standard for a 23-year-old guy. Laundry stuffed in a corner behind the bathroom door, baseball cap collection in the living room, above the couch, a poster of a young woman wearing socks, and not much else. But he's here for reasons that are uncommon to most people.
I mean, I remember vividly as a child going and picking up massive amounts of marijuana with my father. When you're in that environment and you're around drugs and both your parents seem to be functioning perfectly fine, one can only assume that, you know, you're either not ever going to mess around with it or eventually you're going to. I mean, doesn't everybody aspire to be like their parents?
He did follow in his parents' footsteps. He was still a teenager when he started dealing drugs and using a lot of cocaine in particular.
I would at times be up for 2 to 3 days and just completely out of control.
Eventually, Hassinger was arrested on felony drug charges. He avoided doing serious time through Union County's drug treatment court. Part of the deal with drug court involves probation meetings, community service, group therapy, individual counseling, and approved plans for work and housing. Steve Deal is Hassinger's probation officer.
He lived with family members who weren't in the best situation.
and it was in the middle of nowhere, and they weren't really interested in getting him to meetings and to counseling and to a job and stuff like that.
So Hassinger had a housing problem, as many former inmates do. But since 2012, there's been a solution for him and 30 other Union County residents convicted of nonviolent offenses. The Justice Bridge Housing Program has subsidized their rent, making up the difference between the full cost and 30% of the person's income.
Be able to show the numbers that we're showing is a clear indicator that this is a great program.
That's Union County Chief Probation Officer Scott Lazzardi. Participants have a recidivism rate of 37%. Overall county figures aren't available, but the statewide average is 60%. And the program appears to save money. Housing subsidies are income-based, but it works out to, per person per day, about $19 versus $72 to support somebody in jail.
If you reduce your jail population, even by two or three people per year, you've paid for what you've contributed, and you've probably saved some.
That monetary transfer isn't happening, though, because county commissioners aren't supporting the program, saying it helps people who don't really need it. Commissioner Preston Boop has led the push for changes in county corrections and was once a champion of the Justice Bridge program. He says it's rare for inmates to truly be facing homelessness on the outside.
We are not holding people in jail only because they don't have a home plan very often. It does happen. It has happened. But it's not frequently to the point that we need to hit the taxpayers.
Boop also says the county's day reporting program could help people get jobs, even start working and save up for security deposits before they're eligible for release. But once they're out, their income might not be enough to cover rent, not to mention fines and legal bills. And many ex-offenders aren't eligible for federal housing assistance. Most individual housing authorities are strict about criminal records. Pennsylvania Department of Corrections Deputy Secretary Shirley Moore-Smeal says that's been slow to change.
Each county has its own rules and regulations that they are governed by. So it would be helpful if that were not the case, but I think that it is an area that there is still improvements that can be made.
Even housing authorities that are liberal about criminal backgrounds have waiting lists. In Union County, it's 6 months. To help address that gap, the Pennsylvania Commission on Crime and Delinquency has funded reentry housing initiatives all over the state, including Union County's Bridge Program. Its seed grants run out, and the search is on for more permanent funding since Boop pulled his support. Debate over the program continues, but Hassinger says he couldn't have stuck to his probation requirements without it.
That program saved my life. Really. Wholeheartedly, genuinely believe that.
That's powerful. But a consultant's report cautions replicating this project could be tough in places without the close-knit relationships partly credited for the program's success in Union County. It also seems like the program's already at risk for failing there, in part due to this dependence on collaboration, particularly when it involves politicians in charge of purse strings. Emily Previty, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide initiative reporting on the challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY leads the four-station partnership. To hear other stories in our housing series, go to keystonecrossroads.org/housing. As the debate heats up over where to send refugees from Syria and other conflicts, it recalls earlier waves of immigrants who flocked to the U.S. to escape harm. On this episode of Story Corner, Jacob Winterstein retraces the route his grandfather took decades ago to escape the Nazis.
When I was in the fourth grade, my grandfather died. And I sat down in the living room, and my dad rolled out an enormous map on the floor and pointed to Belgrade, Yugoslavia, where my grandfather was from. And he showed us with his finger how my grandfather, his sister, and their parents fled Belgrade after the Nazi invasion to the coast of what's now Croatia, up into Italy, and eventually through the Alps Mountains into Switzerland. And as a child, this story was a story of great wonder. And now, it's a story that's full of questions. What does it mean to be the grandson of a refugee? Does it make me fearful? Does it make me empathetic towards others around the world? What does it mean for me as a person who's lived in the same city his entire life to come from a family where they were forced from their home. The story starts in Belgrade, Yugoslavia. My grandfather and his sister led a good life. They never thought that the war would come to Yugoslavia, but out of precaution, they built a bomb shelter in their house. On April 6, 1941, the Nazis bombed Belgrade, Yugoslavia. My family retreated to their bomb shelter, and they were joined by many of their neighbors, one of whom was the vice president of Yugoslavia. My great-grandmother knew that when the Nazis invaded, that they captured young men first, so that when a car came to evacuate the vice president, she pleaded with him to take my grandfather with him. The vice president agreed, took my grandfather and his government vehicle to the airport, and sent the car back to retrieve the rest of my family. And with bombs dropping all around them, the car made it to a train station. My great-grandparents, their daughter, boarded the train to the city of Dubrovnik. Word got down that my grandfather was captured. One day, my great-grandmother sat in a cafe, and overwhelmed with the fear that her son was going to be murdered, she burst out into tears. A woman she had never met before asked her why she was crying. My great-grandmother explained why. And this woman said, "I know someone that can make fake papers. And my brother works in Belgrade, and he will go to Belgrade and free your son." They did this. They were successful. My family was reunited in Dubrovnik. In 2009, I decided that I wanted to go to Belgrade. I wanted to understand what the journey entailed just so that I could be alive today. So I spent time in Belgrade, walked the same streets that my family walked. And then I took a train to the coast, to Dubrovnik, hoping to find the family who saved my grandfather's life. All my family knew was that the woman who approached my great-grandmother in the cafe, that her name was Miss Yob. I looked for all the Yobs in the phone book, and I just went to the first one that was closest to where I was at the time. And I knocked on the door, and this big, hulking man answers the door, and I explained to him the story. And he opens up another door and goes in, and it's just as I'm getting completely overwhelmed with fear and I'm about to run away, he opens the door, and standing behind him is this beautiful older woman. And she says, "Well, I'm Mrs. Yob. It was my husband who delivered those papers to your grandfather." And it was incredibly overwhelming, the distance that I had traversed, and to sit with the widow of the man that had made it so I could be alive, and to bridge that distant connection between the two of us, gave me great faith in the connectedness in all of us. And I hope that I have an opportunity to be someone that can extend generosity and braveness so that this beautiful gift of life that we all get to experience can continue and thrive and flourish.
That's Jacob Winterstein, recorded at the third annual Freedom Seder Revisited, co-sponsored by First Person Arts and the National Museum of American Jewish History. You can hear the full version of his story and more first person narratives at newsworks.org. Finally, in England, Stonehenge is a revered monument, but a New Jersey town is demanding that Shorehenge be removed from its beach. The Asbury Park Press reports an attorney for the borough of Highlands has sent a letter to the Tilt Up Concrete Association asking the group to take down its seaside monument to the survivors of Superstorm Sandy. Residents have questioned the aesthetics of the more than 1,000-square-foot monolith. Meanwhile, the State Department of Environmental Protection informed the borough in November the structure was not permitted under the Coastal Area Facilities Review Act, which oversees state coastline development. No fines have been issued, however. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by myself and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Perhaps the only thing that got more attention than President Obama's announcement on gun control yesterday were his tears as he recalled the Sandy Hook shooting. We'll talk about male politicians weeping and the flack they get for it on tomorrow's show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Shai Ben-Yaakov for NewsWorks Tonight.
The Cooper Heart Institute supports WHYY. Their multidisciplinary team of cardiologists offers the Watchman device, an innovative, minimally invasive treatment option designed to reduce the need for long-term blood thinners in patients with non-valvular atrial fibrillation, thereby reducing the risk of AFib-related stroke. The Cooper Heart Institute is a comprehensive heart care center with offices throughout South Jersey. Details at cooperhealth.org/watchman.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. It took Beethoven 4 years to compose, and yet it remains one of Beethoven's most seamless, most poetic works. Jan Lisiecki joins Yannick Nézet-Séguin for Fourth Concerto. Plus, the massed strings of the Philadelphia Orchestra play Beethoven's Serioso Quartet. Tickets online or by phone, 215-893-1999, January 13th, 15th, and 16th at the Kimmel Center. Beethoven's Fourth Piano Concerto with the Philadelphia Orchestra.